This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Critical Theory Channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Louisa Han, and I'm really pleased to be joined today by Sita Balani to discuss her new book, Deadly and Slick, Sexual Modernity and the Making of Race. Sita is a lecturer in English at Queen Mary University of London and the co-author of Empire's Endgame. She's appeared in such publications as Vice, Tribune, Salvage, An Open Democracy, and such platforms as Environmedia and BBC. Sita is also a regular speaker at events on anti-racism, feminism, education, sexuality, and colonial history. Sita, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. Great to be here.
Great. Thanks so much for coming on to talk about your book. So just to give listeners just an idea of what's in Deadly and Slick, the book looks at the ways in which the notion of race retains a kind of a sense of authenticity and immutability through its embeddedness in modern sexuality and narratives about sexual difference. You focus in particular on kind of the racialization of British Asians, tracking the regulation of sexual life in colonial India through to contemporary Britain. I found this approach really kind of elucidating in terms of the ways in which it overcomes some of the impasses we encounter with discussions of intersectionality, which can often conceptualize race and sexuality as these kind of flat kind of vectors on a graph that cross over at certain points, but are otherwise discrete, really, rather than, you know, things that are messily intertwined in often quite surprising ways. So with all of this in mind, I'm wondering how you came to write the book.
Thanks. That was a really great summary of what the book is trying to do. I start, in some ways, the germ of the book came when I was, as I was watching the events of the War on Terror unfold, and thinking about how peculiar it was to watch race and sexuality kind of transform in real time. So the War on Terror really accelerates the process by which the category of British Asian, which was, of course, always varied and internally contradictory, but that becomes really divided into new categories, into the category of the Muslim as a kind of separate and threatening racial other. And through that process, Hindus and to some degree Sikhs get kind of folded back into the story of national belonging. And watching that happen in the kind of early 2000s, at the same time as watching the meteoric rise of gay rights, I felt that these two developments had something to do with each other, but couldn't really find a way of fully understanding that. And I think Jasbir Puar's Terrorist Assemblages and her coining of homo-nationalism helps get some of the way there. But I started to be interested in the sort of historical antecedents of that. So I wrote my PhD between 2012, 2013 and 2016, and wrote quite a contemporary account of these developments. And then by the time it was finished, it felt like we were sort of entering a new conjuncture in many ways, with the Brexit vote and this kind of shifting sands of capitalist crisis. So I felt like if I just continued to try and track these developments in the present, I'd always be outrun by history before I managed to publish anything. So I thought, let me follow this hunch that there's a set of historical antecedents here. And I went back and tried to do that work and tried to think about how the history of the British Empire, and particularly its relationship with the subcontinent, could sort of illuminate some of this without simply saying everything is the result of the colonial endeavour, because clearly things get remade in the present. So I wanted to understand those relationships, and really the book kind of developed from there.
Mm-hmm. And we'll go into kind of the particulars of these developments throughout the rest of the podcast. But sort of to begin with, we'll start with a little bit of the theory side, a little bit dry, but anyway. One of the first things that struck me when kind of reading the introduction to the book was the way in which you kind of understand sexual norms and practices through this kind of Gramscian strand of cultural studies. That's, you know, that's best exemplified, I suppose, by scholars like Stuart Hall, Raymond Williams, etc., while acknowledging a kind of a divergence from some of the orthodoxies of queer theory, which might appear at first glance to align better with like a kind of a study of sexual histories. So can you talk a little bit about what you find useful in this Gramscian approach and your book's relationship with queer theory?
Great. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe I'll take the queer theory bit first. So I found queer theory really generative in my own intellectual formation, in its willingness to look at norms of heterosexual life and subject them to a kind of scrutiny. But I think one of the limits, so I think something about like Michael Warner's writing on marriage, for example, I think it's generative, but it often ends up falling into this peculiar and, to my mind, untenable trap of celebrating sexual diversity as resistance, as though going to a sex club is a kind of politically useful act. And I just find that very hard to sustain as an idea. It doesn't seem to me that being into S&M or being queer is in any way kind of useful as a political project. It's just a reality. And, you know, every time this happens less these days, so I think we can talk about why, but anytime an MP or whatever is caught having sex with a rent boy, it's not that this MP is suddenly a kind of political radical. They're usually Tory frontbenchers. So it seems to me that this idea that sexual deviance, if we want to still use that term, is the site of political radicalism needs quite a lot of reworking in the era of putative sexual freedom, in the era of the incomplete but still quite powerful capitalist iteration of the sexual revolution. So I found that in queer theory increasingly hard to stomach. The sort of celebration of sexual difference seemed a bit empty at this point. So I kind of wanted to diverge from that, because I think it takes sexuality as a category already a bit for granted and then celebrates its expressive possibilities. Whereas to my mind, its expressive possibilities are very effectively used against us, right? Sexual freedom is in some ways, I think, the thing we're offered as a sort of compensation for the deteriorating conditions of everyday life. And that's where I think the kind of more Gramscian cultural studies approach really helps, is because it allows us to think about how particular elements function in the total social formation. So Stuart Hall says, you know, that the whole social formation is racialized, rather than thinking about racism as this like totally discrete dynamic. And I find that investment in contradiction, in living in the contradiction and trying to understand it, really useful. And I think this idea of hegemony rather than like merely domination is important, because it shows the ways in which power has to have some element of seduction in it. Like, it doesn't work there are limits to what you can do through sheer domination, and that more Gramscian approach allows us to understand how we submit to and involve ourselves in and participate in the conditions of, in the end, our own marginalization or oppression or limitation, without seeing that as false consciousness, but seeing that as a kind of consciousness. So for me, that approach, because it allows for some of that contradiction to really live, to live and breathe, I think is much more useful to my own understanding. And as just a kind of final element, I think it's understanding of the nation and nationalism as this essential site for the resolving of those contradictions is really important. And I think sometimes the American queer theory, which is where a lot of this comes from, is so focused on the American situation that it almost fails to conceive of it as a national one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, indeed. So kind of by looking at the development of sexuality through these ideas, you arrive at this broad notion of sexual modernity as a framework for which to understand your case studies. So just give us an idea of what sexual modernity means in your book and where it kind of diverges from this Foucauldian queer theory understanding of the history of sexuality.
Yeah, great. So sexual modernity, I think of as having two parts. Like, one part is its promise. And that's the promise that if we explore or embrace the possibility of romantic love or more recently sexual adventure, we will find a kind of fulfillment. So the idea that sexuality is foundational to the self and that the authentic pursuit of it will help us self-realize as individuals. And that in some ways is just the kind of ordinary waters we swim in. Almost every bit of popular media points us in this direction, from Love Island to whatever the latest Pride and Prejudice remake is. So there's that. And I think that's very familiar. And in many ways, that's what Foucault's work is about. It's about that process by which we come to understand ourselves as sexual subjects. And we come to understand that the pursuit of that will offer us self-realization. But I think that this is only half the story. So the fact of this possibility of sexual freedom has not done away with sexual violence. It has not done away with sexual violence in its spontaneous or its organised iterations. So, you know, we still see, for example, surrounding big extractive projects like mines or pipelines, that sexual violence is endemic. And we still see that in contexts of war or deindustrialization, forms of sexual violence tend to take hold. The state sanctioned sexual violence in prisons, in refugee camps, all of this is still very much with us. In fact, in many ways, we might think of it as accelerating. So it seems to me that we can't really talk about sexuality without looking at some of that too. And I think these developments are more connected than they're given credit for. So while the kind of Foucauldian lens gives us a lot to think about power and pleasure and how they play out, he talks about those spirals of power and pleasure. By taking the male European bourgeois subject as his person, as his subject of concern, Foucault kind of ignores both gender and the colonies. So women's experience of early capitalist modernity is quite different from men's, and it continues to be. And the imperial hinterlands are just as important for the making of sexuality as what's going on in Europe. So I wanted to kind of return those to the story. And from that, I think we get a kind of sexual modernity that is both the possibility of freedom and the omnipresence of violence.
So let's kind of talk about how this kind of sexual modernity developed, I suppose. In your second chapter, you explain that like a constitutive element of the emergence of sexual modernity is a move towards studying the natural sciences around the Enlightenment, away from, I suppose, medieval understandings of the body as an element of a wider divine order. How did the move to taxonomize nature and people and the attendant development of theories of evolution come to shape understandings of sex, gender and race?
So it's a long and complicated story, and one that I think has often, in our moment and in studies of race in particular, really focused on Darwin and the idea of natural selection. But I found that if we sort of start the story slightly earlier with the Swedish botanist Carl Linnaeus, we get a slightly different set of coordinates. So botany emerges as a kind of distinct subject of study in the move from thinking about plants as medicinal to thinking about them as requiring taxonomy for its own sake. So colonial expansion means the number of plants known in Europe quadruples in less than a century. And the question of how to organise that new, how to make knowledge of this new information comes through taxonomy. So I found it kind of fascinating that the Linnaean system of taxonomy, which is the one we still use today, basically. So if you've ever heard anyone say animal, vegetable or mineral, that's from Linnaeus. And he categorised plants by their sexual characteristics. Now, basically all plants have both, if you want to think of it as sexual reproduction, have both sexual parts. But this idea that plants were, to use the language of the time, hermaphrodites, didn't sit well with the emerging idea of gender in Europe, in early modern Europe. So instead, Linnaeus starts to conceptualise plants through the relation of their male and female parts. So the male parts determine the class and the female parts determine the order. So again, we see the hierarchy of man over woman there. And I thought this was completely fascinating, that at the time in which plants are being categorised, so are humans. And humans are also being categorised by sexual difference. So racial difference was understood to be most clearly seen in the secondary sexual characteristics of the human animal. So breasts mostly. There's all these bizarre scientific diagrams of women's breasts. So and trying to kind of categorise them racially on that basis. So it seems to me that in some ways the Darwinian understanding comes along in the aftermath and offers a rationale for this, but the taxonomy is there slightly earlier. And this idea that it's the sexed body that is the foundation for determining who should be in what category, to me seemed more important than it had been given credit for. So I think that's where that kind of idea started for me.
Great. So as you kind of note in the next chapter, these understandings of biologically inherited characteristics kind of incentivized hegemonic powers to control sexual practices between different races through narratives of respectability and quote unquote hygiene. And this is something that you explain through the example of British rule in colonial India starting in the 18th century. So can you give us an idea of what racial hygiene meant and the kinds of ideas and programs imposed by the British to protect its colonial power?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I take up the term racial hygiene, which has normally been used in relation to the eugenicist project of Nazi Germany. But I think it's a useful term to expand a bit more widely, because this notion of cleanliness, I think, has a sort of significant bearing on all sorts of contexts. So colonial India is a really interesting example, I think, because it was a relatively small number of Europeans trying to work out how to manage what was called at the time the native question. How can a small number of foreigners control a large population and their land in order to extract wealth from it? And race plays an important role in that, because it offers some kind of rationality for that process. But again, this is where a kind of Gramscian approach yields results, is that you can't, pure domination is not possible. So another form of rule has to be produced. And I think that managing who has sex with whom is shockingly important to that endeavour. So colonial administrators were sitting in rooms in London and Paris and Lisbon and Madrid, trying to work that question out. Who, thousands of miles away, should be having sex with whom? How should it be understood? And what should be made of the children that might issue from those unions? And in colonial India, in the kind of first period of colonial expansion, the simplest solution was seen to be that European or English men there should take concubines. So it was understood that men needed someone to have sex with, to cook their food, to do their laundry, to look after them when they got sick, in effect, to be a wife. That was understood to be the job of a wife. But it would have been costly for European women to, at that moment, fill that role. So the solution was Indian women who were, after all, already there and already had those skills. And so men were encouraged to take concubines or sometimes even just assigned one. And that seemed like a good solution until people started having children. And while that might have been possible to resolve, had long-term unions not also produced emotional bonds? So these men started to want to send these children to school in England, and that sort of seemed like it might cause a bit of trouble. Started wanting to include their concubines in their wills, and that causes all sorts of trouble. So the question of inheritance starts to mess up the kind of contours of racial difference. So if there's lots of mixed race children running about with claims to European parentage, that starts to undermine racial distinctions. So they have to keep renovating that process. They have to start running state-sanctioned, state-regulated brothels in which the sex workers employed to service English men have to be different from the ones that are having sex with Indian men. So we see these processes become completely essential to the management of the everyday workings of empire, and the scrupulous need to maintain racial hygiene, right, to maintain the distinctions between racial groups, really is about managing sex, not just managing who has sex with whom, but whether or not it's mediated by money, where it happens, what happens to those children. And I think that is often slightly obscured, the kind of different ways in which they tried to solve those problems, because though it was relatively recent, our understanding of the actual mechanics of colonial rule are quite dim still. So I wanted to just illuminate one aspect of that, because I think it helps us see how we got to where we are.
Yeah, that's great. And that idea of sort of these developments being improvisatory, I think, is really key to, you know, the argument running through the book. You know, those ideas that are made to seem natural and immutable but aren't necessarily born of a particular ideology, but kind of pieced together in a bid to maintain power, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's important because we sometimes start to see the state and state power as this like tremendous force that has complete self-knowledge, that it made race through its deliberate and self-knowing actions, rather than it having this improvisatory quality where it solves one problem and then creates another problem. It has to solve that. And through that process, we can see how the categories it comes up with to do so are improvisatory, and they are also fallible, and we can exploit those fallibilities.
Mm. So let's move on kind of a century or so to look at your work on the notion of the so-called national family in Britain, and how this idea was deployed for hegemonic ends. So you look at the role of the welfare state in the 20th century in disciplining the citizenry into kind of nuclear family units, while at the same time creating like racialized outsiders for those who didn't fit into such units. So could you just expand on this idea a little?
Yeah, I think there's a dominant story of the welfare state in Britain that begins after World War II and insists that this was the big achievement of the working class. And I think there is some truth to that story. But I think if we don't trace its earlier histories, we run the risk of misunderstanding the ways in which welfare provision is also a contradictory site of subject formation. So it's not only it. And I think anyone who's been at the sharp end of the welfare state, of standing in line at the housing office or having their universal credit card, knows that what looks like being given something is actually having your everyday life quite carefully controlled by some larger structure. So I wanted to kind of think about that contradictory site of welfare provision. And if we go back to before World War One, if we go back to the beginning of the 20th century, we see that there was a concern with the health of the citizenry in Britain, because Britain was losing in the Boer War, the Second Boer War, against the Afrikaner elites in southern Africa, and it was understood that this was because the health of the populace was faltering, and so there was a huge amount of energy expended in trying to improve the health of the ordinary working class Brits for the purpose of winning colonial wars. That was the reason. And it's interesting because when you read some of the reports from that time, they could have been written in the early 2000s, because it's very clear that the reason people's health is falling is they've got really poor housing, and they can't maintain bourgeois families because they can't afford to. So working class people don't live like that because they don't have the resources to. And just as the same solutions are now proposed, like education, go and educate young mothers in the inner cities, that's basically the solution proposed now. They did that, and they put all this money into being like, how we must teach these young women how to look after their children and so on. And that's really the beginning of a kind of welfare provision that's really organised around the health of the national citizen. And so that continues to shape developments for the next 100 years, and it's still with us in some ways. But of course, the health of the citizen has to be contrasted with the potential for that health to be perverted or undermined by the racial outsider. So we see in that post-war period particularly that this idea of the health of the citizen is still with us and has to be maintained through thinking about how working class English people, British people specifically, live. So that is one element, but the other is maintaining the border. So the development of welfare provision and the tightening of national borders work together. And of course, we still see that. So in many ways, that gives us some of what is still the animating force of Powellism. So Enoch Powell's speech about the rivers of blood, and the whip hand are the kind of memorable lines. But I think the enduring alchemy of that quite terrifying speech that still really shapes those ideas and Powellism still really shape life in Britain today, as Kojo Corum's recent work has continued to show us, is that idea of a man unable to get a hospital place for his wife or a school place for his children, this good, decent, hardworking Englishman. And that continues to animate life in Britain, but has these long, long roots in the British polity.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So next up in the book is a kind of a discussion of the development of racial categories under Blairism, or I suppose like third way neoliberalism more generally. And this conjuncture starts to see the embrace of, as you mentioned earlier, kind of this delimited form of queer sexuality that accompanied policy changes like the repeal of Section 28, the introduction of the Civil Partnerships Act, while at the same time the government embarked on these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq and a war on terror that served to kind of criminalise Muslim communities in the UK these two shifts that you draw connections between. So can you tell us some of the ways in which these kind of liberalizing attitudes towards gay people and increasing suspicion towards Muslim people were kind of connected as part of a larger conjunctural shift in the 1990s and 2000s?
Mm-hmm. So I think Blairism is endlessly fascinating for anyone who was born in the kind of late 80s or anyone of that millennial generation, because it was what we grew up under and we're still feeling the effects of it. And you can really see how much shifted in that decade. And I think that the embrace of a certain gay subject was really crucial to that. I think even more crucial than perhaps it's been understood to be. So the repeal of the Thatcherite piece of legislation, Section 28, that criminalised teaching about gay rights by local authorities, happens in 2003, and civil partnerships come a year later, which is very, very quick turnaround. From 2003 to not being able, so a teacher in school feels that they can't talk about gay people in any kind of positive way, to you can pretty much get civil married. Massive shift that happens in a year. And it's the same year as the war on terror really like dials up massively with the war in Iraq. So it seems to me that that all happens at the same time in kind of a vertiginous fashion that starts to reshape life in Britain. And I was trying to think about that, and the obvious person to start with is Anthony Giddens, a sociologist who was really essential to the development of New Labour's understanding of the world. And he is very keen on the idea of plastic sexuality, of sexuality as something that is chosen and that can offer a form of stability in a rapidly changing world. So the idea being that romantic partnerships might be still the best way to organise society, but that these should be chosen and not enforced by the state. So divorce should be available and easy, but the state should do everything it can in positive terms to enforce the centrality of the couple form as something chosen, as something through which we could access forms of stability. And that stability is crucial to allowing us to adapt to global capitalism, to be a flexible workforce. And for Giddens, the gay couple represent the absolute apotheosis of this option, because they have, in his words, had to kind of get along alone without the state's intervention, without the state's support for so long. So for him, gay rights are a kind of, and for that project, gay rights are a way of enshrining the modern couple. So why should gay people be locked out and therefore locked out of being adaptable market subjects? So this, I thought, was quite fascinating at the same time as single parents, single mothers in particular, become this particular sort of New Labourite scapegoat. Got the folk devil of the benefits scrounger, got the invention of the bogus asylum seeker. So there's all of these new threats being minted by New Labour, but there's also all of these, and the terrorist, of course, but then there's also these new shiny modern subjects who can embrace the global economy and be aspirational. And I think the Blair years are really important for kind of enshrining a new cast of characters in the national imaginary.
Yeah, and as part of this kind of focus on the New Labour era, you zone in on a kind of a spate of novels that was released in which South Asian men, quote unquote, kind of come out as adhering to a contemporary British model of individualistic sexuality and kind of rejecting family structures that were supposedly characterised by an archaic kind of excess of tradition that you talk about. Can you put such narratives into context and explain their wider connections to the war on terror and criminalisation of Muslim communities?
Yeah, absolutely. So in many ways, these novels and memoirs were the sort of the spark of the project. I remember reading them when they were coming out between like 2000 and the early 2000s and 2013, let's say, and by Satnam Sangera, Nirpal Singh Dhaliwal, Safraz Manzoor, who all have quite big profiles in the sort of between, like, they've written for the Daily Mail, the Times, the Telegraph, sometimes the Guardian. They're journalists of sorts, though not especially rigorous investigative ones, more like they write features and columns. And one of them, which one? Sangera? No. One of them's recently reinvented himself as a kind of liberal critic of empire who can give the balanced story of the imperial condition. Anyway, they all wrote these novels and memoirs, and they're all almost identical to each other. It's extraordinary. You could take a sentence from any one of them and plop it into the other and you just wouldn't notice. And they're all really about saying, they're all really about wanting not to have arranged marriages and instead to get jobs in the media and marry white women, which is perfectly reasonable if someone wants to do that. But it's quite something for five odd books to be published top table at Waterstones and in the same period of time that all say exactly this. And it seemed to me quite important that these novels were doing a lot of work to fortify sexual modernity, to fortify the idea of sexual freedom as the site of individual possibility against the backwards clannish mores of South Asian family structures. And so I think, you know, they were writing these at the same time as David Cameron was making his speech about muscular liberalism and about how the crisis of identity among young British Muslims was producing these homegrown terrorists. So it seemed to me important that there was a kind of popular literary genre enforcing that idea that David Cameron was making in his speech at Munich in 2011, for example. So I think that in another way is one of the reasons that cultural studies as a tradition is important, because it allows us to kind of triangulate between these developments in culture and these developments in political rhetoric and see how they reinforce each other.
Mm-hmm. So much stuff on the New Labour era from that kind of tradition as well. So yeah. Another aspect you focus on regarding this kind of so-called culture clash narratives is the treatment of Muslim women. On the one hand, there's a kind of liberal idea that the invasion of Afghanistan, for example, was about saving women from oppressive practices. On the other hand, you've got this kind of demonization of now stateless Shamima Begum, for example, who traveled to Syria to join IS. So what is the population of these, the popularization of these very different stories indicate about sexual modernity right now, and what hegemonic kind of purposes do they serve?
Yeah, I think we're living in the shift at the moment. I think that the story of saving Muslim women, or to use Spivak's iconic formulation, white men are saving brown women from brown men. I think we're living in the shadows now, in the aftermath of that story as having its hegemonic force. So I think it's still there as a sort of sediment, to use a kind of Raymond Williams-ish formulation. It's a set part of the sedimented logic. But the emergent or the ascendant logic is something slightly different. And I think the case of Shamima Begum is a good example of this. So the fact of her demonization, you know, she trends on Twitter, I think, more than almost anyone else who's not an actor or a singer or Kim Kardashian. She's constantly trending on Twitter, and the British media are absolutely obsessed with her. I think every male journalist in the world has claimed to have got an exclusive interview with her at this point. It's really something. And I think this obsession, and of course, you know, she's been subject to a quite frightening an extreme new form of statecraft in the form of citizenship stripping, which has been with us since the kind of mid-2000s point of the war on terror, but it's only just started to be used against British citizens with no other citizenship. And Begum's interesting in lots of ways, because the story that we're being told is that she is an insufficiently victim-like victim, and that perhaps victims are no longer worthy of our attention anyway. So perhaps it's not just that Muslim women don't need saving, it's that nobody needs saving. there's a kind of logic here that abandonment, cruelty, neglect are what the state is for. And that if that is being done to someone, it is being done for good reason, not just to protect you from them, but because cruelty is how states show that they are really in power. So I think there's a kind of spectacle of violence here that is about demonstrating that the state can still do something. It can't resolve the cost of living crisis. It can't put food on your table. It can't give you decent healthcare, but it can make sure that someone else is suffering more. And I think that's what the kind of persistent cruelty towards her, spectacleized in the British media, is about. And I think it matters that largely those who most publicly enact this violence against her are also South Asian and often women. So we've seen these days Suella Braverman, but who's more like a kind of pathetic photocopy of the original kind of sadist in this situation of Priti Patel, who takes what's there in Theresa May's kind of nativist belligerence and gives it a fresh spin. She says, I too can do cruelty. It's a kind of equal opportunities sadism here. And I think that these two figures of Shamima Begum and Priti Patel are almost co-constituted in the national imaginary as a way of disorganising racial politics, right? It says, look, everyone can be, anyone could be abandoned and anyone could do the abandoning. I think this is a very important moment of improvisatory statecraft that it will take some time to understand what the longer term implications are going to be.
Yeah, and sort of untangling that helps us in kind of the task of understanding how people are kind of inculcated in a racist ideology without, as you mentioned, kind of reducing it to false consciousness.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think Priti Patel is suffering from false consciousness. I think she knows perfectly well what she's up to. I think that the task is to understand her as part of the racist assemblage that we live with, and that she's not a kind of dupe or a token. If this was tokenism, I don't think there would be so many of them. So it seems to me that we're looking at something quite different to that.
Exactly. So let's kind of move towards kind of finishing up and looking at your final chapter, which is on the treatment of children under sexual modernity. And this is where you look at the recent emergence of seemingly contradictory conditions converging around issues of gender and sexuality education in schools. Can you tell us a little bit about how the figure of the child has shaped sexual modernity and what recent kind of moral panics and controversies reveal about contemporary race and gender politics?
Mm-hmm. So the control of children's sexuality is really important to the sort of Foucauldian paradigm. So he talks about schools and the families as a site for the control of children's sexuality, making sure that children aren't masturbating, for example. That's a kind of big part of how the architectures of boarding schools and the management of the nuclear family become tools of governance in the sort of 18th century, 18th, 19th centuries. But in many ways, that's still with us, right? So the trope around which people seem to be mobilized, most effectively and powerfully mobilized, is the idea that someone is sexually defiling children. So we can see that in all of the 90s panics about stranger danger. People remember the infamous Brass Eye episode. Chris Morris satirized this, and it's amazing that he's had any kind of career since, frankly, because people really were up in arms. And this is an incredibly powerful trope. So, you know, the whole QAnon phenomenon is really about this. And the transphobic moral panic is also completely organised, or not completely, but significantly organised around children. And the easy answer to this is that this is because children are understood to be a site of innocence. But I think we need to kind of drill down a bit into what kind of innocence this is. Because if children were understood to be innocent and deserving, then people would give a damn that children were every day starving. everyday experiencing the violence of war and famine. And that seems to have little mobilizing power. But the idea that children are being sexually abused is very mobilizing. And there's some really interesting work by Julia O'Connell Davidson about this, in which she suggests that it's because we understand children to be outside of the structures of contract. So if contract is an essential feature of modern life, that we have a certain kind of freedom to say yes or no to things, and that's also a site of anxiety. So we might think about someone like Fromm's idea of fear of freedom, right? So our freedom to enter or exit contracts is understood to be crucial to freedom in general. And sexual freedom is a huge part of that, right? That the idea is that our sexual freedom is a freedom of choice. And we understand children are meant to be outside of contract. They're not able to enter into contracts. They're not able to enter into sexual agreements. And that's quite right. But one of the reasons that we put so much emphasis on children, it is suggested, is because they're outside of the adult world of choice. And much of the role of children in fomenting these moral panics is about maintaining that logic that children are outside of the world of choice. So if a child can say, I wish to live as a boy, I am a boy, and they have been assigned female at birth by a doctor, that's understood to be them entering the adult world of choice for which they have no, which they should be excluded from. So they function to kind of shore up that distinction, to give us somewhere that is free of that anxiety. So I think that's the kind of key role that they play.
Great. Thank you for that. I think we've had a nice little whistle-stop tour of like the contents of the book. So I'm just going to kind of wrap up a little bit and just ask everyone, which is, do you have anything you're working on at the moment, any new projects, anything on the horizon?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting transitional period in some ways, because I've been thinking about the ideas in this book for a long time. I wrote it. The actual words on the page I wrote in about a year, but all the ideas that came into it were a long time in the making. And so now I'm kind of trying to find out what I'm going to do next. I'm trying out a few different things. And I suppose the thing that I'm interested in is how our desires surface against the backdrop of our deteriorating economic conditions, and how those desires are used against us by forms of state power. Not the most upbeat project. I promised myself I would do something more upbeat about the ways people resist these conditions, but I think that understanding the intricate mechanisms of how we live against and along the grains of power is kind of where my interest lies. So I'm still kind of working on some new ideas around that, some of which might be about undercover policing. So that's the kind of a little glimpse of what that might be about.
Okay, sounds really interesting. You don't always have to keep things jolly anyway. So just remind me when this book is out.
The book is out on the 16th of May. It's out with Verso. You can, I think, pre-order on the website. And I'll be doing some events in May around the book and probably after that as well. So, yeah. Please do read it or get in touch if you want to hear more.
Okay, fab. Thank you for that. Everyone pick up a copy of Sita's book. And thank you so much, Sita, for really great answers and for joining me today.
Thanks so much.